is so great. We are excited. Today, to celebrate that, we have a bread basket from Great Harvest Bread. We're going to be picking the winning raffle ticket pretty soon, and so you have a few more minutes if you want to get a ticket. It's got some great things in there today, and they're only $2 for a ticket, so you have a few minutes if you want to go there during our welcome. If you wouldn't mind turning off your cell phones, today's program will be recorded for the radio. But before you do that, if you want to take a picture of your friends and tweet about it, our Twitter page, we're trying to get moving, and you can do it at AK World. So take some friends of your food and your friends, and then if you wouldn't mind putting it at least on Vibrate, that'd be great for our radio listeners. And speaking of the radio, I'd like to thank Kari Gardy for doing our recording today. This program is being recorded, and if you'd like to have access to it, you can either find the link on our website, or you can go directly to alaskapublic.org and search under AWAC Presents, where you'll find this program, as well as all of our previous programs on this website. If there are any military students or military personnel, we'd like to thank you all for coming. We have a generous sponsor that sponsors some military personnel, and we love having you here, so thank you so much for coming, as well as, yes, thank you. As well as our students, I saw a great group from Eagle River High School. If you happen to be a student from anywhere, if you wouldn't mind standing and being recognized, we are so glad. So many of you came. Look at that. Thank you so much. Our speaker is thrilled. She's jumping in her seat. And we'd like to thank BP for sponsoring our students. And please come again. We love to have the students at our programs. And don't forget to tweet about us on Twitter. We are a membership organization. You can see the sign here, right here to my right. If you are currently not a member, we have a deal for you. If you become a member today, your membership will be good for the rest of this year. For us, that ends the end of June, and also all of next year. So you get a little bit of an extra incentive. You can sign up either online or at the front desk. And we are gearing up for our ambassador series, which we do every summer. And we've got some great ambassadors who we're talking to. So keep on looking for our upcoming lineup on our website, and think about becoming a member if you like this program and want to support future programs like today. And at this time, I'd like to bring to the podium Ms. Jocelyn Fenton, who is the chair of our WorldQuest committee, and she'd like to say a few words about our competition and winning team this year.
Thank you. So, as a fun little treat, we get to present our certificates to the team from Service High School that won our Alaska WorldQuest Student Academic Competition that was in February. I feel really great to be a part of that. It was an exciting competition, and they beat out 30 other teams. And we just want to give them recognition for that. So come on up and get your certificates.
We are so excited about Service High School winning this competition. It's the first win for Service. They will be going to Washington, D.C. along with their chaperone and will represent Alaska. Our team last year was from Fairbanks and came in the top 10, beating out a lot of private schools on the East Coast. And so we have some great hopes for our Service High School students, and we are rooting you on for that national competition in D.C. So good luck with that. Our next program, if you like today, is going to be on May 1st. It is featuring Lawrence Husick, who will be talking about cybersecurity. So if any of you out there like myself who have been hacked, and want to know more information about that, come out on May 1st and find out from an expert what that means and what you can do about it. And now I'd like to introduce our head table. You met Jocelyn Fenton, who's the chair of our program committee, and to her left is Dr. Paul Dunscombe, who's the chair of our program committee and our incoming chair of the World Affairs Council, and he is going to come to the podium to introduce our speaker today. Dr. Dunscombe.
Thank you very much, Lisa. Good afternoon, and thanks all for coming and sacrificing some time in the lovely sunshine to be here. I am very pleased to have this opportunity to service a very small portion of the debt that I owe to our speaker, Professor Diddy Hitchens. It was she who brought me on, I believe, the very first Friday of my very first semester here at UAA to the Alaska World Affairs Council program, and began my longtime involvement with this organization. And since I think I have proved to have some utility to this organization over the years, as evidenced by my imminent assumption of the chairmanship of the Council's executive board, you can also throw that modest entry onto the credit side of the ledger of what Diddy has contributed to the World Affairs Council over the years in her capacity as member, board member, former president, et cetera, et cetera. Diddy's latest highly appreciated contribution has been to graciously step up in place of our scheduled speaker, whom we hope to have at a later date. So we thank her very much for coming in on such short notice. Professor Hitchens is Glaswegian by birth, but brought up in southern England, which is why we can actually understand her when she speaks. She received her BSc in Social Sciences from the University of Southampton, UK. Her MA in political behavior, spelled a la Inglaise with a U, and her PhD in government from the University of Essex, UK. Her first academic appointment while completing PhD research was at the University of Ghana, Legon, West Africa. Subsequently, Professor Hitchens had a 30-year career in various incarnations of the Department of Political Science at various iterations of what is now the University of Alaska Anchorage, rising from assistant to associate professor, then on to full professor, before enjoying her current status as Professor Emerita, which theoretically implies retirement, despite the fact that she is the most active retired person I have ever encountered. I'll keep the review of her resume brief, since any attempt at full recitation would take most of the hour and risk missing at least one of her significant contributions. Suffice to say that Professor Hitchens specializes in comparative politics and international relations. She served several terms as chair of the Political Science Department and remains a tireless proponent of internationalizing UAA's curriculum, its students, and its faculty. She has conducted research in China, Japan, and the Koreas, as well as in Canada and most of the rest of the dominions, the Russian Far East, and the Arctic. Since 1985, Professor Hitchens has served as the British Honorary Consul for Alaska. She is now the Dean of Anchorage's Diplomatic Corps. She was honored, again spelled a la Inglaise with a U, by Queen Elizabeth II with the Member of the British Empire, MBE Award, in 2005. And was inducted into Alaska's Women's Hall of Fame in 2013. And that does not even begin to mention her talents as a horsewoman or a captain of large sailing yachts. Professor Hitchens is currently working on developing a full-scale international Model Arctic Council following her work on building UAA's Model UN. The Model Arctic Council will be held at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, co-sponsored by UAF and the University of the Arctic, and included in the U.S. public diplomacy priority accompanying the United States' presidency of the Arctic Council. Professor Hitchens is here to speak to us today on the Arctic Council, role and representation in managing global insecurity. Please join me in welcoming her to the podium. Thank you.
Thank you for that kind introduction. I am indeed always happy to be amongst my friends with the Alaska World Affairs Council. I was going to recite my 40-year association with the council, but my good friend, Professor Dunscombe, has done it for me, so I don't need to stress how happy I am to be here amongst many old friends, but also with such a wonderful audience of young people interested in international relations, which is what my career has been devoted to, trying to get young people involved and into leadership positions in international relations. And that's what my current venture, creating Model Arctic Council, is destined to do, to bring young Alaskans into leadership and leadership positions in the Arctic, and what my involvement with the Model United Nations was all about. Having said I'm happy to be here, I'm actually sorry to be standing here today, because I too would have really liked to have heard Stephen Steadman on his topic, managing global security. However, I hope that it's just a postponement and that we'll all get to hear him when he reschedules his visit. I was at a meeting with Lee Svalsko, president and executive director of World Affairs Council, a couple of weeks ago on an entirely different matter, and happened to mention to her that since I had been out of town, I was now back in town, but that I'm always willing to talk about whatever it is I'm currently working on, which is always in the field of international affairs, and that what I was currently working on was the proposal for the Model Arctic Council as part of the US chairmanship of the Arctic Council, its public diplomacy initiative, and that if she had a slot, or if by any chance there was a cancellation of somebody who was planning to speak, then I would be very happy to step in. And she right away said, well, that is a possibility. And then in the middle of the following week, I received an email from her saying, would I please provide her with a bio and a title and a photograph, because it was quite possible she was going to need me today. And would I please speak on the topic that Stephen Steadman was going to talk about, managing global security? So I must admit, I hesitated. I thought, oh dear, that's not really my focus. Yes, security studies is a part of international relations, but security studies, the way it's developed, tends to have a rather narrow focus on risk analysis and assessment, and uses mathematical modeling. And my approach in international relations is much more general and philosophical, and my interest has always been in promoting the role of international organizations, and particularly trying to have the United Nations move more towards bringing about collective security. So I said to, I thought about it, and I thought, no, I really wanted to talk about how wonderful the Arctic Council is in terms of being an entirely new type of international organization. So I thought, well, maybe I could do that. Maybe I could talk about the Arctic Council, its role and representation in managing global security. So I sent in that title, which Lise accepted, and I literally went ahead straight away, and from the research I've already done, I wrote my presentation, drafted it. It wasn't polished, but I drafted it out, and I put it away at least a week ago. And then on Tuesday of this week, I received an email from Lee saying, yes, it's a go, you are speaking on Friday. Unfortunately, Stephen Steadman cannot come. So on Wednesday afternoon, I pulled out my draft, intending to go ahead and polish it up. And I thought, before I do this, I ought to just have a look at his bio and just have a look at what he's been involved in, and make sure that what I'm going to present is at least tangentially related to his topic. And what I discovered was that Stephen Steadman certainly is not a narrow security studies specialist. In fact, he had been, from 2003 to 2005, the research director for the UN High Panel on Threats, Challenges, and Change. He had been Assistant Secretary General and special advisor to the Secretary General on strengthening collective security, and then the chief author of the High Panel's report entitled A More Secure World, which was published in 2006. And then subsequently, he was director of the UN's Peace Building Support Office in order to try to implement the recommendations in the report. And when he left the UN, he became deputy director of Stanford's Center on Democratic Development and the Rule of Law, and co-author of a book entitled Power and Responsibility: Creating International Order in an Era of Transnational Threats, which was presented as a prescription or a blueprint for US foreign policy after 9/11 and the Afghan and Iraq wars, intended to put the United States back into the visionary role of a powerful leader in a world of conflict, but committed to peace. Essentially, to put the US back on the path that first Woodrow Wilson and then Franklin Delano Roosevelt had launched the United States into after the First World War and then the Second World War, into being a leadership in the collective management of global security. Well, seeing what these documents were, I thought I'd better read them. So thank heavens for the internet. It was all available online, and so I did what I have done on many occasions before, and that was very, very fast read of two substantial documents. So if I look a bit tired, it's because I haven't had two nights' sleep previous to this. And they were not only fascinating, but entirely in accordance with the line of my thinking, rather than being in that narrow version of political risk analysis and security studies. I have to say, I was truly impressed. And as a result, I felt I better pretty much rewrite what I was going to say, and rewrite it so that I would be able to supplement my views by showing how I think the Model Arctic Council as a new, innovative organization fits in with this view that he was putting forward. So that's what I did, and that's what I'm going to present to you now. Now, you might well think that the major focus area for global threats is not the Arctic, but the Middle East. But that would reflect an anachronistic view narrowed down to thinking of security purely in military terms, rather than the much broader contemporary view of human security, which we now have. Human security that is globalized and interconnected, and which recognizes no national boundaries. Throughout the Cold War, from the late 1940s to the early 1990s, the Arctic was without question the most dangerous area of the world, where two nuclear-armed superpowers faced off over the frozen Arctic Ocean in a ghostly standoff, underpinned by the aptly acronymed doctrine MAD, Mutually Assured Destruction. Both superpowers, armed with the capability for nuclear annihilation in a sparsely occupied Arctic, which both superpowers had essentially usurped from the tiny indigenous populations that had survived and sustained remarkable lifestyles and cultures from time immemorial in unimaginably harsh and remote conditions. Only first explored, or as we say, discovered by outsiders in the early years of the 20th century, by the 1950s, those outsiders were militarizing the Arctic with distant early warning sites, Air Force bases, and intercontinental ballistic missile delivery systems in a necklace around the Arctic Ocean, right across the Soviet North, and then on the other side, not just across the United States, in other words, Western and Northern Alaska, but also through alliances right across Northern Canada, Greenland, Iceland, and Norway. It was the development of nuclear technology and delivery systems that made the Arctic so dangerous and so insecure, lying as it did between two hostile and nuclear-armed superpowers. In earlier eras of human conflict, the Arctic had really not been significant because it had been barely populated. Like other species, the basic human instinct is for survival. Humans need water, food, clothing, and shelter, and use their unique endowment, the ability to reason and communicate extensively by language, to organize for that survival, first in small groups, which had been the focus of many political philosophers, and most notably in the Western tradition of Thomas Hobbes in the 17th century, who wrote that without political authority, human life would be nasty, brutish, and short. Hence the ubiquitousness of political authority in human societies, intended to ensure security and survival through law and order, with protection and within an organized group. However, from the very earliest times, these organized groups also came into conflict, both internally and externally, over the means of survival, natural resources, and the delimitation of territory or of ownership of the territory on which those resources were found. Much of our knowledge of ancient empires is their wars over resources. And we know the Middle Ages for its insecurity and the lack of protection for survival. The modern period of history from 1648, when the Treaty of Westphalia brought the 30 Years' War in Europe to an end, marks the emergence of the nation state. And these new nation states in the 17th century, Spain, Portugal, England, France, almost immediately embarked on worldwide exploration to discover and claim natural resources, gold, timber, fur, etc., and to claim those territories where those resources were found to be exploited, thus establishing new conflicting empires and colonialism. Some of the wealth from these new colonies and resources was devoted to developing new and more powerful weapons of war. From the sword, the lance, and the spear, to guns and tanks used on land, sea, and ultimately also in the air. With every development of weaponry, there was more carnage. And moving from warfare that just involved those in the military and was targeted at the military to warfare that impacted more and more of the general populations. There had always been some conventions regarding behavior during conflict. For example, throughout most of human history, it was a convention that was accepted that if combatants raised a white flag, then it was to indicate surrender or the desire to speak, to parley, and therefore they should not be attacked. The extent of the carnage and the suffering on the battlefield after the 9-hour battle of Solferino in 1859, which was part of the Second Italian Civil War, in which 5,000 died on the battlefield and 22,000 were wounded, with unbelievable and indescribable suffering of those left wounded on the battlefield, resulted in a campaign by a Swiss, Jean-Henri Dumont, that eventually led to the first international law regarding the conduct of war, which became the Geneva Conventions, with which we're all familiar. Then the horror of industrialized trench warfare in World War I and the extent of those casualties, 8.5 million soldiers killed, 21 million wounded, and 10 million civilian deaths, led to several proposals at the Paris Peace Conference in 1918 for an organization to maintain world peace, which resulted in the creation of the League of Nations, in which Woodrow Wilson, president of the US, played such an important part. In World War II, it was the bombing of cities, most especially Coventry, Dresden, and Hiroshima, that led to a second attempt to achieve collective security with the creation of the United Nations. But for a variety of reasons that are well known and far too numerous to go into now, the United Nations plan for collective security was really never implemented. And instead, the management of global security, or perhaps we should say global insecurity, that prevailed during the Cold War was the MAD doctrine, mutually assured destruction, that I already referred to. And in fact, it was quite effective in containing conflict. The balance of terror was a constraint that ensured no direct superpower confrontation using their nuclear capability. And although the Vietnam and other wars occurred during this period, relatively, the Cold War was a period when all-out military conflict was contained by the nuclear standoff, most clearly demonstrated in the Arctic. But with changing leadership in the Soviet Union, some thawing of the Cold War began in the 1980s and was greatly accelerated following the Chernobyl nuclear power station disaster of April 1986. A catastrophic nuclear accident at a Soviet nuclear power station in the Ukraine that resulted in large quantities of radioactive particles being released into the atmosphere. The world did not first learn of this disaster from the Soviet authorities, but from reports of raised levels of radioactivity 2 days later in Sweden and in Finland. Only then did the Soviets admit that there had been an accident. Huge areas of the Ukraine Russia, and Belarus were contaminated. But there were also significant amounts of fallout at various places right around the world. Initially, Sweden and Norway received heavy fallout, and probably Finland did as well, although that wasn't reported at the time. And subsequently, scientists studying the after effects reported the accumulation and concentration of fallout from the Chernobyl disaster in the Arctic, which persists to this day. Chernobyl gave the whole world pause about threats to security. But it was taken most seriously by those wealthy European middle powers with democratic socialist governments that had instituted welfare states to try to ensure domestic well-being and lack of conflict and tension, and which were striving through their participation in UN functional agencies to address global problems in order to minimize tension in the world and provide the highest possible levels of security for their populations. Leading amongst these states were Norway, Sweden, Denmark, and the Netherlands. But no matter how much they did to ensure domestic harmony and the lessening of global tension through UN activity, there was nothing they could do to shut out nuclear annihilation, whether arising from a nuclear accident or from nuclear warfare. Post-Chernobyl, Mikhail Gorbachev, who was still Secretary General of the Communist Party at that point, made historic speeches in Murmansk and in Vladivostok, calling for the Arctic to become a zone of peace. While at home, he committed to policies of glasnost, openness, and perestroika, restructuring. By the end of 1991, Gorbachev had been overthrown in a coup d'etat, and the Soviet Union had dissolved. With the demise of the other superpower, there was no longer a Cold War. For some, the early 1990s was a period of hope and opportunity to try to get back to that vision for global peace and collective security that had been represented in the Security Council and the provisions for collective security of the UN. But when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait and the US went to war against him, such hopes faded. And then there was conflict in the former Yugoslavia, 9/11 happened, followed by wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and conflicts in the Middle East and North Africa continuing to this day. It seems that since the end of the Cold War, there has been constant conflict around the world, with receding hopes for collective security and UN provisions. But meanwhile, despite the extent of conflict in the 1990s, there was one area where cooperative initiatives took place at the end of the Cold War. The end of the Cold War brought about a thaw in the Arctic. Initially, it was indigenous peoples of the North whose family ties had been disrupted by the Cold War who wanted to reestablish their links. Alaskan Aleuts and Inupiat met once again with their cousins across the Bering Straits. And at the other northern end of the vast Soviet territory, there were meetings between Sami from Russia, Finland, Norway, and Sweden. During the late 1980s, links between Alaskans and Russians in the Far East burgeoned, from friendship flights to all manner of social, educational, and commercial links that led to the creation, sponsored by Alaska governors Cooper and Hickel, founded in 1989, the Northern Forum, an organization of subnational regional governments founded to promote northern development and better communications, not at the high politics, diplomatic level, but at this lower, more regional level that allowed more direct communication and sharing of problems. At the same time, there was a Finnish initiative that led to a 1989 conference in Rovaniemi on the protection of the Arctic environment, which not only reflected back on the impact of Chernobyl, but also pointed to early evidence of what was then called global warming, which we now refer to as climate change. This meeting led to the Rovaniemi process. The process involved extensive research of the issues and serious effort to ensure that all interests were represented and that all those who were interested had a voice. And because indigenous peoples were the major population in the Arctic, and because they had historically, traditionally been impotent, been powerless, and not had a voice, the Rovaniemi process specifically recognized and supported the opportunity for indigenous people to have a full say and to bring not only their experience to these meetings, but also to incorporate their traditional knowledge regarding climate and the environment of the Arctic. This process involved a number of meetings and a lot of workshops and culminated in the June 1991 Declaration on the Protection of the Arctic Environment and the Arctic Environmental Protection Strategy, which was developed by the eight Arctic states with the ongoing official participation of three organizations of Arctic indigenous peoples, the Sami, the Inuit, and representatives of the many Russian indigenous groups of the North. This was truly a historic turning point for the indigenous peoples who had never before participated and who had never had the opportunity in high-level diplomatic proceedings relating to the Arctic to put forward their interests, their traditional knowledge, and their views. And those things were actually incorporated in the preparatory process that resulted in an international declaration. The Arctic Environmental Protection Strategy outlined objectives that required extensive data gathering and input and continuing assessment and monitoring, thus involving a series of follow-up meetings. Sustainable development was added to the Environmental Protection Strategy in 1993, and at a meeting in Inuvik, Canada in 1996, the Rovaniemi process and Arctic Environmental Protection Strategy became absorbed into the creation of the Arctic Council. Canada actually took the lead in creating the Arctic Council. During the Cold War, Canada's north had been militarized and subject to Cold War constraints. But as Canada, after World War II, took a leading role at the UN and addressed global problems that often arose from civil conflict, increasingly thoughtful Canadian politicians and leaders and governments realized that responsible sovereignty required nation states to ensure minimum standards of human security and social welfare for all their citizens within their borders. But the Canadians realized that they had a serious domestic problem. The status of Aboriginal peoples in Canada, including in the Arctic, was dire. Misguided policies, boarding schools, and settlement of nomadic peoples, though well-intentioned, had made things worse. Indigenous peoples were living on welfare, but still in poverty, without hope, and with high levels of child mortality, domestic violence, substance abuse, poor housing, poor education, and little opportunity. After several parliamentary inquiries in Canada, the Canadians began in the 1980s to try to respond with land claim settlement that were long processes that purposely and intentionally operated just like the Rovaniemi process, inviting all interested parties to participate and to have unconstrained opportunity to voice their interests. The result was land claim settlement throughout the Canadian North, new policies for Canadians, for Indigenous people not in the North, but also the creation of a new Indigenous majority territory of Nunavut with self-government. At the same time, Canada was fully engaged in and committed to the Rovaniemi process and determined to create a new international organization for the Arctic to protect the Arctic environment and promote cooperation among Arctic states with the full involvement of not only Arctic Indigenous peoples and their traditional knowledge, but also the other inhabitants of the Arctic. The Arctic Council was a novel institution. It was not part of the UN system and not a fully fledged international organization, but a high-level forum. The word forum has that element that everyone gets invited to a forum, that it's not decisions being taken in secret by elite diplomats, but that it is an open meeting where everyone should get to voice their interests. And the Canadian proposal accommodated the idea that such a forum should make decisions that incorporated the needs and traditions of Arctic peoples through permanent participation. The basis for founding the Arctic Council, the idea that threats have to be mutually recognized to be dealt with, that today's threats recognize no national boundaries, that no state can, by its own efforts alone, make itself invulnerable. At a time of mistrust and widening cultural abyss, the Arctic Council was founded to support cooperation for mutual gain based on knowledge, understanding, and unlimited input. With its initial focus on environmental protection and response to climate change, and then enlargement to embrace sustainable development, the Arctic Council has now recognized the full dimensions of human security, and that development is an indispensable foundation for security. Poverty and lack of opportunity, combined with environmental degradation, threaten human security. When poverty is added to ethnic or regional inequalities, the grievances that stoke civil conflict are compounded. Sustainable development is needed as a foundation for security. Amongst the indigenous peoples of the North, there were a whole range of social problems being experienced at the time of the founding of the Arctic Council and on till today. Poverty, food insecurity, poor housing, education, lack of opportunity. And these problems exist in rich, developed nation states of the North. Not one of the Arctic Eight is a less developed state. But there are and have been discrepancies of power and wealth, of injustice and inequality amongst the populations of these democratic, developed northern states. And in the founding of the Arctic Council, these problems were recognized. To some extent, the development of natural resources of the North in the latter half of the 20th century and now in the early 21st century are beginning to redress the disparities. And the Arctic Council exists as a new kind of international organization designed to manage conflict and insecurity in this one global region, the Arctic. The fact that the Arctic Council is so innovative is because it is new and it has been so recently created. And it reflects contemporary values and thinking and new style diplomacy. Towards the end of his period as Secretary General of the United Nations, Kofi Annan, in 2003, created a high panel on threats, challenges, and change. In 2004, that group issued their report, A More Secure World, Our Shared Responsibility. And Stephen Steadman, who should have been here today, was the chief researcher and author for that panel. They worked for years, they had access to everybody they needed to talk to, and they identified 10 global threats: poverty, infectious diseases, environmental degradation, interstate war, civil war, genocide, other atrocities such as sexual slavery and kidnapping for body parts, weapons of mass destruction and proliferation of chemical and biological weapons, terrorism, and transnational organized crime. The panel concluded that all threats are interconnected, that development and security are inextricably linked, that extreme poverty is a fertile breeding ground for other threats, including civil conflict, and the indivisibility of security, economic development, and human freedom. The report also mentioned that threats must be dealt with simultaneously at multiple levels, local, national, regional, and international, and that no state alone is invulnerable. That differences in power, wealth, and geography determine our perceptions, and that inequitable responses fuel further divisions. To be dealt with, threats have to be mutually recognized, and everyone affected must have a voice. Security depends on early warning and analysis, objective and impartial research, the need for constantly developing capacity for strategic options, the need to have well-trained and briefed mediators, and dedicated efforts that can find cooperative solutions, but that solutions require consensus. Otherwise, you just have to keep talking. The conclusion is that in international relations, governments must be aware of their responsibility, and sovereignty must be exercised with responsibility. Now, soon after this report was published, Kofi Annan stepped down as Secretary General. For the period he was still in office, Stephen Steadman had the responsibility for actually trying to reform the United Nations, and most particularly how the collective security mechanism was working, and had the responsibility for, where possible, implementing the recommendations in the report. But he wasn't in that position for very long, and with the change of Secretary General, essentially this report, it's still there somewhere on a shelf or maybe in a work group, but nothing much was being done about it. And so Stephen Steadman decided that it was worth trying to see if this material and these proposals couldn't be presented to the US people and US administrations as a new opportunity for US global leadership. And so he took what was in the report with a couple of other authors and essentially came up with his book, which is a prescription and a blueprint for US leadership for managing global security in these innovative ways. And it seems to me, having read these proposals, that we are in a uniquely unbelievably rich opportunity now for the United States to actually embark on its chairmanship of the Arctic Council with this research and this understanding as part of its approach. Because the Arctic Council is already a reformed institution. The Arctic Council isn't part of the UN system, which is impacted by failure to achieve collective security in the past. The Arctic Council is this new model. The Arctic Council encourages not decision-making in secret by elite high-level diplomats, but instead a forum where all interested parties are provided the opportunity to present their positions, where there is investment in research, where there is willingness to listen to alternative points of view, including traditional knowledge as well as science, and where significant conflicts exist. But with this model and with this commitment to try to do things better and to resolve conflict by peaceful means, the US can essentially, during its chairmanship, which begins next month, use the Arctic Council as a demonstration project for a better way of managing global security. Thank you.
Wow.
The brilliant Dr. Hitchens will be answering some questions. I know we might be going over a little bit on our time, so I want to do the breadbasket now in case somebody has to leave early. And if I could ask Dr. Hitchens to please pick the winning ticket. It is 225970. So if you have 225970, you can pick that up on your way out. Do I have anybody waving that ticket? Aha, congratulations. And now Dr. Hitchens has graciously agreed to answer some questions. I'll bring her back to the podium. And if you could please wait for the microphone for our radio listeners.
Sorry.
Hello, Diddy. That was a brilliant presentation. On many of our minds here, of course, the Middle East looms very large. And my impression is that the Secretary of State for the United States is part of a effort for global security in which he, in fact, is speaking for the National Security the UN security, and indeed the UN totally. And are we, in fact, suitable for global leadership in this if our own internal politics make it impossible for him to act like he is a global leader, and where it would seem that our America going it alone seems to be a preferred way of doing business?
As you could tell, John, in my presentation, I was optimistic. I personally have had a lifelong and professional commitment to the possibility of peaceful resolution of conflict. I absolutely believe in diplomatic means, appreciated that the old UN arrangements just didn't work because they weren't adequately democratic, and that they weren't expansive enough to be able to move us towards peace. And that's why I seized upon Stephen Steadman's work and my own involvement in the Arctic Council to make this optimistic presentation. But at the same time, I'm living in the same world you are, and not only am I completely disappointed by the extent of conflict and the nature of those conflicts, I have to be careful here, but as you know, I'm a Brit, I'm not an American, but as someone who is a student of the US political system, I'm deeply depressed at the minute about the extent of internal conflict. And as a professor of political science, my view is that democracy in the United States at the moment is completely overpowered by the power of corporations, and that we really don't have a satisfactorily functioning democratic system. So how can the United States actually encourage everybody else in the world to resolve things through more openness and more participation and acquiescence to democratic demands when its own political system has narrowed down and is less responsive to democratic input because money is playing such a big role? And in particular, the situation that we're in right now, where the president, no matter what his initiatives, it appears to be the case that they are going to be entirely thwarted by majorities in both houses of Congress that are hostile to everything that he stands for. So Much as I would like to see the United States have the integrity that would permit it to be this leading democratic bastion for maximizing that type of decision making in the international arena, I'm not very optimistic about its possibility at the global level anywhere except this opportunity right now that we have in the Arctic. And I do so hope that we will take it and that we will use it to the maximum of our opportunity. And then it will be like a case study that can demonstrate now we need to expand that to other areas, even the Middle East.
Steve Conkle, Dr. Hitchens, thank you for that brilliant address. I have a very broad and agenda-setting question and one more specific. And we know that environmental conditions are changing in the Arctic. I share your optimism that this is really important for the world, and there is a very long history that goes back. In terms of the agenda of the Arctic Council, and as you mentioned, environmental protection, environmental degradation, excuse me, they were very much on people's mind when they created the Arctic Council, and sustainable development has become a way forward to look at challenges, opportunities, and shared responsibilities. And the eight circumpolar north countries can have that vision as that being very important in the Arctic. And yet we face more issues worldwide when the Ukraine can affect relations with Russia, with relations with the United States and our portion of the Arctic. So I guess to cut to the chase, in terms of the agenda of the Arctic Council, would it make sense to have climate change and health or something like creation of resilient, healthy, sustainable communities, which focus really on the Arctic communities as a major agenda? And second, my specific question is, with respect to conflict in the past in this broad view, and a lot of native populations basically getting run over by the conquering populations, what is your thoughts about the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, which was the 44 million acres and $960 million that affected Alaska Natives relative to the Canadian land claims, how those have been settled, or even how we used to deal with these things with reservations and things in the lower 48. And
wow, that could be about three more speeches of equal length, I think. Ah, now I've forgotten what the questions were. Clearly, in response to your last question, we do already see in Alaska, as a result of ANCSA and as a result of the creation of corporations, especially here in Anchorage, you look around and every day there's a new fantastic building that has the name of a native corporation on it. So clearly, I think the United States, in its role in the Arctic Council, can hold up this as a model that can result in fairer sharing of resources and that can have a significant impact in the other areas of the North. Certainly, that wealth has not eliminated problems in the Alaskan North, although we hope it will, and there are just the same but perhaps more extensive problems throughout the rest of the North. And I think people associated with the Arctic Council are particularly concerned about the indigenous peoples in the Russian North. In the last few years, Mr. Putin's government actually prevented RIPON, the Russian Association of Indigenous People of the North, from being represented. They've only just reinstated them and let them come back to the table. And it's very evident that, you know, the headquarters of the organization is in Moscow and that it is very orchestrated. So going to your other point about, with conflicts elsewhere, what can be done in the Arctic Council? Amongst the representatives, the senior Arctic officials, but also I think the governments of the eight, despite the conflicts and the tensions over Ukraine and other matters, there has been an agreement that they will continue to work constructively and cooperatively at the Arctic Council. And for example, whereas visas for Russians coming here and for members of the Arctic Council countries going to Russia, those visas have been slowed down or stopped and the sanctions have had an impact on other areas, there's been a real significant effort to ensure that the work of the Arctic Council has not been impacted. So already, even before the US has taken the chairmanship, again, for the second time, currently it's Canada, there's evidence that this organization has a life and an energy that is sufficiently valued mutually around the Arctic by all the members, that it is being allowed to continue to function and being supported to function well by all of the members despite those other conflicts. And I think that that is a very remarkable and positive sign that it's not just Canada or the Scandinavian countries, but certainly both the US and Russia that have significant mutual interests in this organization, that they all recognize they cannot achieve except through cooperation. And so in that respect, despite everything else that's going on, it seems that the Arctic Council has a potential to really make a contribution, a positive contribution in this area.
I've actually had the opportunity to see you speak before, and I'm just really appreciate the clarity, the insight, the depth with which you speak, and being able to have a role model like yourself located in Anchorage. I do really appreciate that, so thank you. I did have a question as well. So I was curious, you kind of brushed over it in your speech, but I think a very unique element of the Arctic Council is that it deals with human security that's inextricably tied to climate change into how we manage the environment. So how do you think the Arctic Council, as opposed to other governing and human security organizations, can deal with human security through recognizing the environment and moderating the environment, especially since it is sovereign territories that we're talking about?
Thank you. I appreciate your kind words. It's the very fact that the Arctic Council has taken as its work plan human security that is inextricably linked in everything that the Arctic Council says in all its documents with climate change. That means that that issue of climate change will get this really broad approach with all possible input from all possible perspectives that I think means that it will be able to eventually come up with plans and programs for how to live with climate change. I think it's the extensive scientific basis, but also the traditional knowledge. And it's because, and maybe I forgot to say this, and if I did, then I'm very remiss, that the Arctic Council only takes decisions on the basis of consensus. It can only actually issue a formal decision if it has consensus. And working to consensus in a forum where you have allowed the presentation of all possible perspectives is a lengthy and difficult process. Much of that work gets done in the workshops of the Arctic Council. Now, workshops of the Arctic Council are big. They've got lots of people participating in them. And they draw on the best global expertise that is available. Some of that expertise, I'm delighted to say, is Alaskan expertise. When you look at the work that's been done on the Arctic Ocean, on marine issues, and the contributions of Lawson Brigham from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I mean, just a world expert on these issues. And that expertise is put at the service of the representatives of the nation states and of the peoples and of the communities in these workshops where everybody has the opportunity to put forth their concerns and to put forth their interests, and which just keep going. I don't often quote my old deceased fellow countryman, Winston Churchill, but my colleague Jim Muller will be delighted that I do. Most of the world holds him in the highest regard. And one thing he said, to jaw is better than to war. And he wrote books and they were so extensive. He was somebody who really appreciated the need to have everything totally researched and documented before you make a decision. And that's the hope for the Arctic Council. It may be very slow, and there are huge numbers of meetings and lots of people involved, but that's how you arrive at a satisfactory consensus.
Last question.
Hi, my name is Max Bullock. I'm a senior in UA's Global Logistics and Supply Chain Management program. And I had a question about, as USA begins chairmanship for the second time of the Arctic Council, what would be a policy that you would support for the best and safe use of international trade through the Arctic region for ocean vessels?
That's exactly one of the major focuses of actually not one but two of the Arctic Council workshops. They've been working on it for a long while. It's in that area that Lawson Brigham has made his major contributions. There have been any number of really significant conferences held involving, I think a lot of people wondered, why on earth would Singapore want to be an observer at the Arctic Council? The answer is because Singapore has a major interest in Arctic shipping, and they want to ensure that their voice and their interest is represented, which it is being. They have become an observer, but even when they weren't yet a recognized observer before 2013. They nevertheless were invited and had the opportunity to contribute. The Northeast Passage along the coast of Russia is already being regularly used, has been ever since the 1960s for resupplying northern communities. The Old Northwest Passage, much, much more difficult because it goes through islands and indeed even a source previously of conflict between the US and Canada, which in other respects have been allies. I think the speed of climate change is surprising us all and pulling the rug out from under our feet, essentially, because while much of the research has been looking at how do you have safe passage shipping through these passages, and that meant you have to deal with the conflict between Canada and the US over how you're going to talk about borders and whether those are internal waters or whether they're international straits, which much time has been wasted on. In fact,